Welcome to Think Big for Africa podcast. On this podcast, we will bring you interesting conversations with local, national, and international African leaders from all walks of life, home and abroad. Leaders who are doing their bits to progress Africa's development. Conversation topics will range from education, science, health, leadership, politics, business, and many other global issues. Conversations about everything that concerns Africa's development. Africa has so many wonderful achievers worldwide, and this is exactly what we will bring to you on Think Big for Africa podcast. Stay tuned.
Hello. This is Think Big for Africa podcast. My name is Ekene Banye, your host. Today, I have a very interesting young Nigerian who has been asking a lot of questions about Nigeria as a whole, about how he and other youths can define themselves in the current Nigerian society. And that is the main reason why I brought him here. Because he's asking a lot of important questions, which I believe that many of us need to ask. His name is Basil Abia. Basil, how are you?
Very fine, sir. I'm very good. Sorry we couldn't hold it when we had initially planned.
Yes.
But it's a privilege to be here. And
very good.
I can't wait to
talk to you. Yeah. So, Basil. Just tell my audience about you.
Okay, yeah. There's nothing really much or complex about me. I'm your typical young Nigerian, very optimistic about the future. What I currently do and what I've done in the last 5 years, basically found a way to navigate around the Nigerian society using certain skills and on the journey, of course, learning certain skills. So I studied international and comparative politics, and that meant that I had a bit of tools given to me through the knowledge I acquired in school. And some of those tools included analysis, basically from a research perspective, and then, of course, the ability to communicate clearly. And I started that with journalism. I was the Abuja correspondent for Next Edition Nigeria, an investigative online news platform that is still very active to date. So I was basically in charge of the reportage from the Abuja nexus of Nigeria. And of course, basically in charge of Northern Nigeria in that regard. And from then on, I was quite privileged to switch to humanitarian management. I was the program manager at Margaret Comfort Foundation, a charity organization based in Southwest Nigeria, headquartered, of course, in Accra. After 13 months, I came back to Abuja to become a think tanker, to become a research assistant at the Center for the Study of the Economies of Africa, where I continued to develop my research skills, having been a research assistant to a Boko Haram researcher by the name Professor William Hansen, who has now, due to ill health, has now returned back to Germany, but used to live in Nigeria for quite a long time. And thus, after a few months of work with the think tank, I decided to basically go freelance, go on my own and continue to offer my research skills, but on a more flexible platform. And thus far, that is what I'm currently doing. I offer my research services to some think tanks based in Nigeria. I offer my research services to a network of think tanks called the Southern Voice, basically an organization of think tanks in the global South, Latin America, Africa, and South Asia.
Very good.
Yeah, apart from that as well, I consult for businesses, tech startups, and I'm currently a research analyst at a tech startup based in Abuja. Okay. So yeah, that's basically what I'm doing. I'm offering my services.
See, I will tell you, like you told me how young you are, I'm very, very proud that you have done all this. I mean, and you're doing things that I never at that age did, you know, and I'm proud. I'm proud. The first time I got to hear about you was when I read a short article about your adventure on Clubhouse.
Yeah.
You know, when you asked the question, I saw the question I saw on the article, it says, being Nigerian 101. So that's a question I ask you. What is being a Nigerian 101?
Okay, so first and foremost, and let me just clarify.
Yep.
We haven't, as a cohort, as a group on that platform, we haven't found the answer yet.
Yes, good.
I haven't found the answer personally because I'm currently on the journey to finding that answer. And sometimes leadership means you taking that mantle to actually define it. I'm very inclined to take that leadership position very soon as to defining what it means to be a Nigerian and laying it out in a framework that can communicate to as many Nigerians. The general conception right now, whenever I talk to Nigerians from across all board, when I mean across all board, across all walks of life, across all ethnicities, is that we are really confused about what it means to be Nigerian. We do not even know what Nigeria stands for. And in a situation, you'd expect that framework to be developed by the state. The state in this regard is basically the federal government of Nigeria, the underlying governing body of the entire country. But that hasn't been provided in over 60 years of our existence. This is where, of course, people can take the leadership on their own and build a movement of it. And that's where I'm thinking towards right now. And part of it is where my book that I'm currently writing attempts to answer. My book wants to answer what it means to be Nigerian. It wants to be the number one framework in that regard. And it's quite weird, but in Nigeria, we haven't had a situation where people outside of the purview of the state, people outside of the purview of the governing structure, have actually taken that leadership position. With this book, I want to take that leadership position where you don't need to read the constitution to have an idea of what it means to be Nigerian. There's already a Nigerian who has done the hard work of defining what it means. And then the other hard work would now be getting as many Nigerians on the same page with that framework.
This question you're asking is a question many of us have asked. And many of my generation made the mistake of thinking that the government should have answered it. See, I will say this. There are very few countries where the government answered this question. Okay? The people who actually answer this question are the intellectuals of the country.
Completely agree.
Okay?
Yes.
See, they answer the question not in one go, but from debates, books, right? See?
Articles.
The articles. See? The Enlightenment in Europe answered this question for modern European countries, okay? By all those philosophers arguing, writing books, okay, dishing themselves, right, and providing the framework for people around the society to read their thinking.
Completely agree.
Okay, so to answer the question about Nigeria, even Africa. In fact, right now, I've been writing a script about African Enlightenment.
Yes, which is very important.
See, for me, I think this is the big thing that we never did. Okay? We have been independent for over 60 years. I'm talking about Africa, okay?
Yes, most of Africa.
Yes. And we never sat down to ask ourselves, who are we? Unfortunately, because Africa didn't document a lot of things before the Europeans came. See, there are so many things that we did in the past that we never, we never know because we didn't document them. We didn't document them in a book. Yeah, we use art. Okay.
Yes. Well,
if I ask you today, do you know what the art in your hometown mean? No.
You're right. No, absolutely.
So the thing that Europe has done is that because they have been writing for a long time, see, if you look at Europe and Asia, they have a long history of written works.
Yeah.
Okay. And from this documentation, you can see who they are. That's what we as Africans need to do. So I'm saying this because you are starting it, but you can end it. You're only just starting it.
Of course.
Good. Yeah. So I'm hoping other young Africans, other young Nigerians and Africans can follow your step to ask the question, who are we?
Yes.
Right. So
I'm hoping that happens. I'm hoping that that particular framework triggers a debate, a nationwide debate. I think it's only right to do that. Let's see how it goes, you know, for me. And then I feel like I owe to Nigeria, to Nigerians and to future Africans, a bit of my intellect in that regard, trying to answer these very salient questions about our existence.
It's a big question, but it's the most important question we need to answer.
Because I really agree.
All the things that we have been doing for the last six years, none of them has really worked. Okay, the NYSC scheme hasn't done a lot to bring us together.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. In fact, when I was in the bathroom, I was thinking, see, many of us find a way to evade the tenets of the NYSC, including myself, unfortunately. Okay, I went to school in Lagos and I did my NYSC in Lagos because an auntie of mine in Abuja thought about, hey, Ikene wouldn't like to be posted to a remote place. And she just went to the NYSC office and put my name in Lagos. I didn't know. So I know a lot of young people in Nigeria, after they finish school, they make sure they get their posting to the place they want. So what I'm saying
is more prevalent now. It's actually more prevalent.
Exactly. So the role of the NYSC to integrate us hasn't worked.
Completely agree.
So this work is very, very important. It is very important.
It's very important. It's tough as well.
Exactly. It's going to be very, very tough. And this is the reason why when I saw that article, I said, wow, this young man is somebody I want to talk to. Okay. So maybe as you go along on this journey, I would like to be a fly on your wall reading writings, you know?
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Good. So, Basil.
Yes, sir.
Last year was a good year. I'll say that. A good year because, even though we went into a global lockdown because of the pandemic, young Nigerians made their feelings known to the whole world.
For the first time in a long time.
Yes, NSAS protests. Like I told you before we started, the main reason why I'm not in Nigeria today is because of my fear of the police. As a young man from the age of 16 to 33, when I left Nigeria, I was constantly being harassed by the police. Many times, the police will cock their gun, then they will shoot me. And they tell me, we'll kill you and nothing will happen.
They say it these days as well.
Yeah. And I've seen the police less than 10 meters by me shoot two people on Ikorodu Road. So, see, I've seen these things happen. Okay. I've gone to the police over 10 times just because I refuse to give them money on the road. So I understood what the protest was about, okay? And I was proud that young people of Nigeria came out and say, enough is enough. Now, we know how the protest ended, okay? And I was sad, very sad that young people lost their lives in the way it happened. And today, we're hearing government officials, both the federal government through the Minister of Information,
yes,
and the state government through the legal counsel of the government, trying to debunk the report of the panel that the state government set up to find out what actually happened. I mean, when a government that set up a panel starts to debunk what the panel says,
yes,
what are they trying to tell us? What are they telling you and your mates about their desire to actually find out what happened?
Yeah, so first and foremost, you have to look at it from a holistic perspective if you want to try and understand why the government is reacting this way. The general comprehension, especially from that, I don't know if you watched the interview that Arise conducted, I think just 2 months ago, with the president of Nigeria.
No, I didn't.
Okay, yeah, it's actually on YouTube, so you can after this recording you can check. It's really painful to watch. It's a painful watch, in all honesty. But at some point, the president makes mention of us as kids that tried to use that October period where we protested to get him out of office. So generally, whenever I read literature related to Nigeria, even literature written by non-Nigerians on Nigeria, the perception is that the governing structure is very paranoid and very, very particular about regime security. So I did not know where they got the information that we're attempting to eject them from power. But the general conception from just that communication that the president was able to make 2 months ago is that they viewed the general October protest of 2020 as an anti-establishment protest, and they needed to quell it. And one of the ways to quell it was to violently send a message to the entire movement through the Lekki shooting. And when they did that, they tried but failed to cover up their act. And it was almost like they were trying to showboat, show a bit of gamemanship by setting up that panel. Of course, through the Lagos State government.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to signal to international bodies that they were still intentional about doing some things right. I don't know how they intended it to be, but 3 weeks ago, when the panel wrapped up their reports, it was actually leaked before they actually published it to general public. It was actually leaked. I mean, thank the heavens for whoever leaked it.
the
media. The general message from the report, of course, was just to corroborate what we already knew, that the military were behind the massacre, and that the massacre was, of course, directed from the, as we all know, you can't hold that kind of operation without directives from Asurok, and without also a cry for help from the a governor of a subnational unit, and in this instance, of course, the governor of Lagos State. So it's generally gamemanship. We all know that they created the conditions for this terrible event.
Yeah.
And they were trying to cover their track by showboating to the international bodies that this is what they're all about. And unfortunately, it didn't work out for them. So like they always do, this is another tool outside their tool bag. And the tool in this case is, of course, mass denial. And they're going to keep on this denial for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Probably even come up with documentation saying that this panel was a kangaroo panel and no one should hold it serious. So yeah, it's typical Nigeria all over again. I'm sure you followed the Oputa panel when it was set up. Similar thing, you know, just for the theatrics, the dramatics, but at the end of the day, the people that should actually have been prosecuted, no prosecution were made, no restorative forms of justice were made possible. It was just for gamemanship, for people to view on national TV, and that was all.
Yeah.
So this is just a repeat of it.
I mean, I've listened to two people recently in the last few days. One was Adeyinka Olumide Fusika, the lawyer of the victims, who he came to the panel. I listened to him on Arise TV maybe 2 days ago, you know, when he was brought on to talk about the what the council of the Lagos government was doing, you know. And he said that even at the panel, the same person was bringing up so many different reasons this happened, you know, trying to debunk everything, okay? And for him, he says it looks like all the Lagos government wanted to do was, like you said, just to show to the whole world that they were doing something. But they didn't want anything to come off from this panel. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, is it yesterday? I watched on Politics Today. This gentleman, Segun Awosonya, you know, a panel member, he was brought on to talk about what the Honorable Minister of Justice was doing, you know.
Yeah.
He says, I mean, he's a member of the panel, that they did their job, you know, but now the government is just trying to put all kind of hurdles against that the report, you know. So the truth of the matter is this: the panel was not supposed to come up with any concrete evidence, okay, and then somehow
they would throw it under the carpet.
Just like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And the members of a panel did a job that produced something the government never expected, you know. It's sad. It is sad.
It's incredibly sad. And to be honest, I wouldn't even lie. This was actually quite surprising that the panel brought about some tangibles, because a lot of us, and when I talk about us in this case, it's young Nigerians who were very active during the protest. I, for one, I was very active with physical protests. I was beaten by police officers, evaded water cannons. Like I was water cannon countless times, evaded arrest as well in Abuja for the 2 weeks of the active protest. Obviously, we still have those good relations with other members who were protesting as well. And we've had conversations post-protest conversations. We have even tried to build coalitions, but unfortunately, they have failed. Most of them have failed. But the general conversation when the panel was set up was that it was another kangaroo show and we're not going to expect anything. So it was actually very surprising 3 weeks ago to actually see that there was actually a report, and report with evidence that looked like they actually did a lot of pragmatic and surgical investigative work. And kudos to them. No, a lot of Nigerians did not expect that to happen. So it was actually surprising that we still had the report out. But again, as usual, the government would find ways to rubbish the outcome of that particular panel.
See, like I told you, one of the things I regret as a young man in Nigeria was that I never took active participation in protests and in politics. I never did. I'm very sad about that. Okay. Because I look at Nigeria today and I blame my generation. Okay.
In all honesty, it's actually not your generation.
Yes, you can look at the people before me, but I know
the class of 1966.
Yeah, I know. Let's look at this. In 1966, yes, how many people in Nigeria were graduates?
Very minuscule.
Exactly. So compared to my own generation, by 1990, there were millions of Nigerians who were graduates.
Agreed.
Okay. So even though, yes, I look at the generation of 1966, okay, they are the beginning of the failures. Okay. But for me, I look at people of the 80s and 90s. We had the opportunities, okay, to do what you are doing today. And we failed. We had the opportunity to do what you are doing today, and we failed. Okay. And I look at myself, I didn't have any opinion about anything. In fact, I refused to have opinions about anything. And that's
So from my own perspective, sir, I do not think that it comes to having some form of collective or personal culpability. In the case of Nigeria, it's been largely multi-generational. So if we're trying to, which I will never do, but if we're in a stage where we have to apportion some blames, I think it's a multi-generational.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, apportioning of these blames. But again, it's also, from my own end, it's also very complicated, very complex. I've learned the last 6 months of my life to try and see that when problematizing Nigeria, what do I mean by problematizing? Trying to identify ways in which Nigeria is problematic, we should try and understand that this country is such a complex country to understand.
Oh, yeah.
And anyone who is bringing about simplistic forms.
No,
You know, it's actually just a runner.
So I agree with you wholly. But see, for me, just like you said, I don't want to paint any generation other than mine. Okay. I look at, okay, what could we have done? Okay. So the older generation can look at themselves, but I look at my own generation. What could we have done? Okay. Like you said, it's a very complex.
Yeah.
And we need to actually do what you are doing. Start talking about this. Right. So I see it as an exciting coming generation to dissect all the problems, you know.
I actually don't see it this way. And there are reasons why I don't see it this way. The general perception, I don't know if you've heard about this word, it's a pidgin word called Japa. It's quite popular now.
No.
It's very popular. amongst, okay, Japa is basically Nigerian pidgin for come out or go out.
Okay.
Basically means emigration. Yeah. So that's the general phrase right now amongst Nigerians of my age and lower. So basically Nigerians in my own generation are more preoccupied with emigrating. It almost feels like this is the early to mid 90s where a lot of Nigerian professionals were leaving for a lot of reasons.
Yes.
Mainly because of Abacha, but also because of the high inflationary conditions of the country. And they knew that their skills were highly sought out outside the country, so they had to make that sacrifice to emigrate. In the case of this country, Nigeria, it's quite similar. NSAS helped to trigger that, especially with the massacre at Lekki. It triggered a lot of people to say, you know what, we used to have hope in the country, but now I think it's time for us to leave. Also, a combination of the fact that a lot of the skills that young Nigerians are now imbibing are skills that are highly sought out
right now internationally.
Coding skills, a lot of young Nigerians are very good coders, very good in software, developing software. They're highly sorted out. Design, product design, even research, for instance. And you know, the basic professional courses as well, to date, are still highly sought out. So we have professionals like lawyers, engineers, medical doctors, nurses, pharmacists. They are still in the ones, especially the UK. UK are looking for as many as tens of thousands of Nigerian professionals. Canada wants to fill in at least 3 million more people, you know, in the next 5-10 years. So these are countries that are hunting for our talent. And our talent, of course, have to leave because we have very high inflation rates. We have a government that is close to being dictatorial. And conditions aren't really good. So even though I know that from the vantage point, because of the NSAS and because of a lot of other things, it feels like my generation is quite exciting. From my own perspective, it feels like 90% of my generation will be no longer in Nigeria in the next 10 years.
Wow.
And it's very scary for Nigeria's fortunes in the coming years.
Hmm.
But that's just my own perspective. I might be wrong.
Well, for the sake of Nigeria, I hope you're wrong. Okay?
Yeah, I hope I'm wrong
as well. And for the sake of Africa, I hope you are wrong.
I really hope I'm wrong.
Because those of us who have been outside the continent, many of us want to come back to Africa. Now, see, I use the word Africa. Okay, I didn't say Nigeria.
Yes.
See, I say this, I make sure when I talk to my friends, I say Africa. Because I look at the fortunes of Africa as one unit. Okay. When it comes to international relations, okay, it's Africa and the world. Okay. And Africa is behind and Africa needs to catch up. And Nigeria is going to be a very vital part of the catching up. Okay, so I hope your view about Nigerians of your generation leaving the country is not right. Okay,
now, yeah, I hope so as well.
Yeah, now I've talked to some of my friends about the NSAS protest, okay? And yes, one of the things we talk about a lot is that, yes, your protest was very good, but we know that any other protest like that will be quelled the same way, okay? So what can you guys do? And we talked about the numbers of the generation, okay, you guys have in numbers to pick the next set of people in public office? Are you guys working towards that?
So, to answer your question about, from my own very limited vantage point, yes, we're working towards that. There, because of the protest, there have been a lot of initiatives that have been created in the last 8 months. Eight months. Because roughly a lot of the conversations started around November, December. So generally, I'll just say the last 12 months, there have been a lot of conversations that have moved past conversation stage to organization stage. I happen to volunteer for WeVote. I haven't done a lot of field work for them in that regard, but I'm hoping that in 2022, which is crunch time prior to the elections in 2023, I'll have the privilege of time to do that. Basically, what WeVote are doing, and this is led by Obinna Shishiohu, a lawyer, very young, same generation or same age group, and that's it, 35 and below. What WeVote are trying to do, this is just one example, of course. Mm-hmm. Basically trying to ramp up political education with voter education at the same time.
Okay.
So not only educating people on the importance of getting involved in the electoral process, because from our own perspective, because we have the numbers, we believe we should fill up all those numbers when it comes to the polls, regardless of attempts to suppress us or attempts at voter suppression.
Yeah.
We also believe that voter education cannot go without political education.
Yes.
People to understand the existing political frameworks that Nigeria functions at. People need to understand how local governance works. People need to understand how and what the responsibilities of their representatives from the local level up to the presidential level are. So people need to be aware of this entire process. And it's quite difficult for a lot of people because almost everybody is fully involved in one venture or another to feed.
Yeah,
but we believe we can do that job. We're ramping it up in terms of resources. We're ramping it up in terms of logistics. And I'm glad that I joined in quite early to volunteer. There are other arrangements just similar to WeVote. These arrangements span across, as I said again earlier, span across political education, voter education, civic engagement, youth mobilization, grassroots mobilization. They are not enough, but they are a start. To answer the second part of your question, asking what young Nigerians are doing, I'll say currently, young Nigerians are also very, very positive about running for office. This is unlike 4 or 5 years ago, which wasn't the case. Obviously, there are a lot of hurdles that have to be sorted out. First and foremost, there is a very high entry barrier when it comes to electoral politics for young Nigerians.
Yeah.
They just don't have the resources. They may have technical know-how, but they just don't have the resources to be able to compete. And we're going to have to find a way to submit those hurdles. I believe in incentives quite a lot. That doesn't mean, of course, that I am a market-driven person. But I feel like with the way things are going, market-driven forces would help reduce the high barrier entry in the coming electoral cycles. So in the next 2-3 electoral cycles, because there are more young Nigerians showing interest in running for office, one way or the other, market forces will drive down the prices for instance, accessing, say, the letter of interest to run, the certificates of entry for these elections, paying for membership and the rest of it, as well as membership fees for these political parties. There are also a few political parties that have been formed by young Nigerians. Again, I'll also say to listeners or to viewers that while it is very plausible that everybody is very apprehensive about the movement post-ENSAS, it's important to understand that movements take 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
They take a long time. And this is not to say that you should be depressed about the outcomes. No. Just be able to trust that the little trickles, the little drops of water here that young Nigerians are dropping here and there. At one point in time, the philosophy of compounding or compounding results will basically work in this regard. And we're going to see in the, at least the next 10, 15 years, we're going to see results of the compounding of a lot of these activities. One thing I should use probably maybe as a critic or a criticism of the post-NSAS movement throughout Nigeria is that it hasn't gone at the scale we would have expected, first and foremost. And two, there's a lot of individualism.
Okay.
Almost
very good. I'm happy you noticed. Yeah, okay, good.
Almost everybody is setting up something because they want their name out there.
Exactly.
Very little or no persuasion or enthusiasm about collectivism in this approach. So we would need to come to the, to the negotiating table very soon, build consensus. And it doesn't mean that we'll build coalitions outright. No. All we just need to do is our collectivist approach means that we're sharing information, we're sharing technical know-how. Most importantly, we're sharing resources, especially financial resources, and pulling people together in that sense. So for instance, a practical example, so it doesn't sound like I'm just rambling words together a practical example of that would be when running for office, particularly looking at grassroots public offices, like councillorship, ward councillorship posts, and local government chairmanship posts, as well as at state house or assembly posts. We do that collectively, regardless of the ideological or political differences that we may have, regardless of the fact that our political parties may be different, because right now political parties are not ideological engines.
Exactly.
They are just umbrellas that we use to enter the flood water or the rain. Figuratively, that's actually what these political parties are. But in practicality of what collectivism will look like for young Nigerians is to, regardless of these differences, pull resources together, maybe set up a collective, call it a name, call it the
Sorosoke. Any name you choose. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorosoke Collective. Anybody who signs on to this Sorosoke Collective gets 3 months of electioneering training. So we have people who are trained to train people how to run for public office, give them communication kits, give them know-how kits, share the same political consultants, the same communication consultants together. Basically, it means that we're sharing, we're all eating up the body. So instead of spending 10 million naira to run for state house or assembly, I only get to spend 2 million naira because every other person has chipped in 2 million naira and we're sharing the same resources. And when we get to do that, we also share those same resources when we are accessing these tickets to run for office. And when we run for office, whether we fail or we win, we learn, we make sure we are documenting the entire
process. Very good.
And we're learning from it. So we're having debriefing sessions after these elections. And I'm very sure that, say, out of 10 collectives across Nigeria, one collective might be outrightly successful in getting as many as 20 young Nigerians to public office. That may seem in the long run, in the larger picture, in the larger sample size, as a researcher, when the sample size is that large and you only have very few success points, it sounds like a failure. But in the case of a movement, that is proper progress because we have gotten a few of ourselves into office and we are now trying to learn where we failed for the other collectives. Okay. And I think when we do that, we tend to see the movement spiral. What do I mean by the movement spiral? When people see a practical means to accessing public office, they come in their numbers. So instead of just 1,000 participants in those collectives, we now start to have 10,000. We now start to have 100,000.
Now, see?
And that moves. That becomes a mass product. That becomes a product of a mass movement. And now, I think that will be progress.
Basil?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. I totally understand what you're saying.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And I agree, the concept is sound, but maybe I'm wrong here. But let's look at you as a person.
Yes, sir.
Your skills, your articulation, your know-how, your worldview. What percentage of the Nigerian youths have those things?
So not to sound like I am trying to
be performative. Just answer the question. Don't worry about how it sounds.
Oh, okay. In all honesty, from my own vantage point, not enough.
Exactly. Do you see the trouble?
Yes.
Yes. There are very few people who understand this end-to-end dynamics. Education is the problem. You see, there are very few people who understand what you just said. And this is what this is what the current political system
is
exploiting. That, yes, there are young Nigerians who have ideas, who know how to do it, but they can't do it. They can't exercise their ideas because the people they need to get them into position do not understand those things. See, I had a young man on here, Yusuf Ramadan. He was here some episodes ago, and he mentioned this. He said, unfortunately, the older generation have been in power, and it seems they are doing everything to make sure the next generations are not educated enough to the extent that they wake up and say, oh my God, these guys have not been doing the work that they should be doing. We need to get them out of office. See, maybe you have a 10%. I don't know if it's even correct. Up to 10% of your generation that understand what you just said to me.
It's probably lower.
Exactly. And this is it. This is the big problem that Nigeria and Africa need to take care of first.
So I completely agree, sir. I think I'll come at this from a perspective using Albert Einstein's saying, which I think is very important. Those who know have a duty to act.
Oh, yeah.
And regardless of the fact that we may not have the population or the sample size that will conceptualize a lot of these frameworks, we still have a duty to act. We still have a duty to organize within ourselves. And you're right. You're quite right. One of my biggest dilemma is actually communicating to the mass. Not because what I am ideating, the knowledge products I'm producing are not good enough, not at all. It's largely because there's a communication gap. And I'm an Hausa phone, so I speak multiple Nigerian languages. I speak Hausa, of course. I can communicate to a larger mass, say, not in Nigeria. But the problem is, even though I'm speaking the same language to them, the concepts I'm trying to explain to them, they just don't get it because they're not that, you know, they're not that in the know, you know.
You're correct. Now, why I brought this up is that I want to make sure you and your mates understand this.
Okay? Yes.
Because
very important.
Because this is the problem. As long as you identify this problem, then you can work on it. Okay. Now, the way you guys have decided to go about it, I don't know exactly what you guys have decided to do, but this is the problem you guys need to solve in the next 10 years, okay? Give yourself enough time to educate your electorate.
Yeah.
Okay.
So political education in tandem with voter literacy, education
literacy
for the long run.
On the long run.
Literacy as well, yeah.
On the long
run. So rather than be in a hurry, look at it from a long game perspective.
Exactly. That's it. Exactly. Right? Good. See, I like our discussion.
Yes. Very. I mean, for me, it's the conversations like this trigger new thinking points.
Yeah.
Which is the most important utility for conversations. Because if you can enlarge your course via a conversation, then you can actually get better at some ideas.
Exactly.
I'm already thinking about a lot of things now. And all I need to do is after this conversation, I work on these ideas to be better.
So this morning, I was just watching YouTube. because that's where I get the news about Nigeria, watching Arise TV and channels. So I was on Arise TV when I saw this video about 19 Nigerians that were accused prison. Yes, 15 years ago. 15 years ago. They have been in prison for 15 years. So this morning, wow. See, this is the issue with the Nigerian criminal justice system.
Yes.
And this is what corrupt police, politicians, and rich people use to cow young Nigerians and poor Nigerians by telling them, I will find a crime, paint you with it, and then they'll put you in jail for a long time. While you fight it, you will be in jail. So what's the solution?
So generally, a complete overhaul sorts it out. But it's
How are you going to do that?
Yeah, it's easier said than done. So I'll just give a data point that helps you to understand the enormity of the problem. Actually, this is from the correctional service itself. Roughly over 70% of the inmates across Nigerian prisons are actually still awaiting trial. These aren't folks that the courts have damnified them and given them time.
Sentences.
They haven't been given time yet. They haven't had access to the proper judicial processes to hear themselves out, to hear their crime out, or to get clarified. And to be honest, more than half of these 70% inmates who are still awaiting trials are actually flagrantly innocent, clearly innocent. It's just that they don't have the monies to be able to post bail. They do not have the monies to be able to afford legal representation. And then you have a situation where some of them are actually, just as you said, actually put in there by wealthy Nigerians, wealthy Nigerians who just want them to be there and rot for as long as possible.
Yeah.
So you there is already a massive epidemic in our correctional system. The over congestion of our correctional centers. We used to use the word prisons now, but thankfully we have changed the language. Correctional system is a better language, far better language. But the most pivotal work would be to overhauling the entire criminal justice system of the country, as well as further reforming the correctional system.
Mm.
That would need a lot of political will from the public office holders. But most importantly, the civil society will have to push harder. Exactly. Now, there are a few lawyers who have set up legion funds basically for free. They decide to go into this correctional centers and get as many people awaiting trial as possible, justice, to get them out. Basically, an unofficial way of decongesting the correctional services. But at the end of the day, it's not scalable because it's just individual efforts. You would need a nationwide effort, which would probably need a presidential office or a presidential committee. I do not know how you want to do that. But I think with political will coming from either the presidency or the Attorney General of Federation and Minister of Justice, or even the bench, the Supreme Court bench, the entirety of the Supreme Court bench, this, I feel, should be a personal project of theirs. But that is not a priority. So it's all about prioritization. It's all about political will. Unfortunately, we can't get any of these things done. From a personal perspective, from my own end, one of the things I would love to do with more resources is, apart from political education, apart from grassroots mobilization, another thing I'd love to do is get a couple of lawyers, afford them first and foremost, and then galvanize efforts towards getting into these correctional centers and getting as many people as possible out of the system. That is just for me a personal intention.
Yeah.
I don't know if it works, but most importantly, at least there's some efforts being done. But the solution to this, as you have asked me, is generally two things: political will and prioritization from a very important arm of government, which is the judicial arm, they actually have the powers to decongest.
Yes, they do. They do. But let me ask you one question.
Yes, sir.
How many of the senior judges in Nigeria are below the age of 50?
I really can't come across, or I can't say the numbers because I've never come across any data set, but I can assure you that that number is very minuscule.
Exactly. Okay. I don't know the numbers, but I assume, okay, yes. Maybe I'm wrong. I assume.
No, I think an educated assumption is that, it's very small.
See, these are the issues. See, when you are, say, as a judge, you have a different worldview. Okay. See, the issue in our society is that people in power have a total different worldview from the people they are governing. This is a fundamental issue across Africa. The people in power have a totally different worldview from the people they are governing. See, this is why we need young people to start getting into position so that, I don't expect every young person who eventually gets into power to go there and from day one start doing everything correctly. No.
Yes,
okay?
You're right.
But when we have enough people of that generation in there, they can debate things in a different way. Okay, debate different things in a different way and come up with a different conclusion based on their worldview. See, Africa is 70% below 35.
Yes.
So we
very
need,
young population.
So we need young people governing young people. See, I say in Africa, we shouldn't have anybody age of 55 running for executive office. Because, see, what you're going to do is not for your own generation. You know? See, you can't be lodging your opinion on people who are so different from you. That's my view. So we have a lot of work to do. But like I said, it'll be the next 30 years will be interesting.
Yes, you know? Very interesting to see.
Yeah.
You're right.
So, for the last how many years? Maybe 5, 6 years, 7 years. We have had the kidnapping headsman problem, the separatist group. And Boko Haram.
Yes.
This has been, a big...
Different dimensions of chaos.
Yes. So how do people of your generation see all this? And what are you guys going to do? I mean...
Well, so, first and foremost, quite a tough question and very broad question.
it's a tough question, yes. Yes.
It's a tough question, but very well thought out. I think I don't want to speak like I'm speaking on behalf of every single
Of course, I'm asking your own opinion. Yes.
Yeah. My own opinion about this is that generally we've had to work three times as much as we would have expected at this time of our lives as Nigerians. Normally when we were growing up, probably say up till our adolescent age, we weren't really faced with a lot of problems apart from, maybe slight inflationary issues, and then maybe the continuous devaluation of the naira. Mm. But we coming into that, living that adolescent age, getting into adulthood, we were forced to face the insurgency problem in the Northeast. I particularly, for instance, having lived on, you know, a major part of my life in Adamawa State.
Okay.
I lived through the early days up to the middle ages or the middle era of the Boko Haram insurgents, which started actually earlier than a lot of people think. It didn't start in 2009. It started in 2003.
Wow.
And it was a gradual process. Yes. It was a gradual process. First, it was mental. So it was just largely educative. We started to see violent extremist education at a very large scale. If you listen to radio between 2005 and 2009, in that part of the country, you know exactly what I'm talking to. Mm. Most of the tamsils were laden with a lot of those information. But we really didn't really take a lot of notice. We just felt it was a bunch of rogue preachers going out of the way. There were signs, of course. The signs were that socioeconomic conditions were deteriorating, which was to date is still a very important catalyzation or catalyst for violent extremism to take the new turn. It also helped me in terms of understanding that I at some point in my university education, I was actually a research assistant to an expert in religious extremism. And I worked on two papers that have already been published in international research publications, as well as being peer-reviewed.
Okay.
One particular research article talks about religious extremism in northern Nigeria. And the other article, which is even quite possibly the most cited, I think cited over 200 times.
Wow. That's cool.
Compounded. Talks about the deprivation theory and how the Almajiri, the practice of the Almajiri kids actually makes them a fertile ground for recruitment by northern extremist groups like Boko Haram and, of course, the lot of them. I can share the links with you. And that was actually my introduction to research. I did a lot of quantitative as well as qualitative research work, conducted a few focus group and key informant interviews with some of the informants who helped us with the information to frame this research articles. And I think if I didn't undertake this academic sojourn, I probably my understanding of this problem would have been very limited.
Mm.
But by virtue of the privilege of undertaking those academic sojourn, I get to know, analyze, and synthesize the entire problem from diverse perspectives. So from an academic perspective, this was always bound to happen. In fact, this is a metamorphosis of the Metecine crisis. I'm sure you're well aware of my Metecine crisis that happened in the 1980s. It was brushed away as a migrant problem. Shehu Shagari thought that most of the Ghanaian, Cameroonian, and Nigerian aliens, as well as the Chadian aliens, were behind this mass extremism.
Yeah.
And when they were exterminated, of course, by the incoming military head of state, Muhammadu Buhari, everyone just went home asleep, forgetting that even though the physical or the kinetic work of handling that insurgency was done, there were non-kinetic activities that needed to have been done.
Those
non-kinetic activities, ensuring that the ideologies that gave birth to Metecine were dismantled by, of course, positive progressive education.
Yeah.
Secondly, of course, ensuring that religion was practiced in such a way that was for the development or the upliftment of the people and not for the destruction. So when we didn't sort this out, we allowed the late 1980s to the 90s to the early 2000s as a gestation period for these ideas or these ideologies. And unfortunately, we started to see some signs. 1998, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, the lot of northern Nigeria was replete with a lot of ethno-religious spats, ethno-religious crisis. We know the unfortunate Jos crisis in 98, 99, in 2001. We know the unfortunate Kaduna crisis in 2000 and 2001. We know the Kano riots between 2003, 2001, and 1999. We even, at some point in the Southwest as well, we know about the Sagamu riots between the Hausas and the Yorubas, and also sometimes mostly sparse between the Christians and the Muslims. So these were little pointers telling the establishment that, look, we need to quell these issues, but we also need non-kinetic intervention. So for just to make sure that the language I'm using here for this podcast is accessible, when I mean non-kinetic or I mean kinetic, basically I mean that kinetic is largely force, militarist force or violence from a state authority.
Yeah.
State authority monopolizes violence in the structure of the society that we, most societies around the world, violence is monopolized by the state. And then non-kinetic basically are the non-physical violence.
Education.
Education, socioeconomic palliatives, infrastructure, provision of jobs, and enabling environment for economic activities to thrive. Unfortunately, we didn't do these things. And even the kinetic interventions were not sufficient enough. Because when we snuffed out these ethno-religious spats, we did not snuff out who the sponsors were. We didn't investigate at depth as to where they were getting their influence from, where they were getting their technical support from, where they were getting their finances from, and the rest of it. And largely, we allowed the problem to compound until 2003, where a group of politicians decided to use this particular group, who were then, at that point, non-violent, but were espousing violence as one of their methods for activism. And when they were abandoned by the same political establishment after the elections in 2003 in Borno State, it will happen that between 2004 to 2009, they started to develop capabilities. They started to go for training sessions. They started to go for mass indoctrination exercises in Yemen. This is well attested in research literature now. Started to get influence from that particular Middle East terrorism nexus. And then, of course, they had access to financing. And from 2009, it became a full-blown insurgency with well-organized terror units. And now it is now a full-blown unit. So, it's no longer just Boko Haram insurgency. It's a combination of both. So you now have violence or violent insurgency in northern Nigeria that's divided into two parts. You have the religious fundamentalism angle, which is basically where they use religion as a cover to met out a lot of these violence, or as the reasons for the persuasions for a lot of these atrocities they're committing. And then you have the non-fundamental religious angle, which are mostly, of course, very economic, the bandits that we now refer to, which are generally still, technically still terrorists, because what they're doing is, full acts of terrorism. But it's largely from an economic perspective where the more they kidnap, the more they have access to ransom money.
Exactly.
The more ransom money they get, the more access they get to buy these arms, the more powerful they get to continue to dominate territories. So it's no longer the case that state authorities are now monopolizing violence in northern Nigeria. It's actually a battle of violence monopoly, both by non-state actors and state actors. And these non-state actors are what they're causing. So this is just a general summary of the problem. To answer the question, just to wrap up from this perspective. My own thinking about this situation is that it is stalling our chances at growing. It is affecting our chances at knowing our country. We can't, in fact, it's very difficult to know our country now because almost everywhere you can't travel to.
Exactly.
You can't even use the train right now to Kaduna, for instance. Wow. So imagine if you have a research expedition for someone like me who's a researcher. It's going to be quite difficult to access a lot of these spaces in northern Nigeria. It was still difficult 10 years ago, but it's far worse now. At least I could embark on a trip to Kano to conduct interviews with some research participants. I can't confidently enter the road now and access Kano. I have to fly. So my costs are higher. For me to be able to access Taraba State 3 weeks ago when I did, we had to fly. There was really no way we could. Yeah, and 10 years ago, you could access from Kaduna to Taraba is not more than 8 hours. You're there. It's quite close. But you have to fly now because you don't want to be at the risk of kidnapping gangs or violence in that sense. And this is a situation where even if you go down south, it's still a problem. There are known state actors that are now monopolizing violence.
Yeah.
In the form of separatism, in the form of just playing out violence without any ideological underpinnings. They're just people picking up arms and causing chaos. So it is everywhere. Violence from non-state actors is becoming democratized as the days go by. And it's going to be a problem for young men.
Now in Nigeria, arms are everywhere. It seems anybody can just decide to buy.
Yes.
And you can get, I mean,
what? With the right resources. Yeah. Actually.
You know, it seems, is the government doing anything to stop this? The access to arms.
Well, in the research field, the last 10, 15 years, I don't even, you can even use Google Scholar to check what I'm saying. Just search for Nigeria and combine the keyword search with small arms proliferation. We have been talking about this for 10, 15 years. Nothing has happened. Nothing has changed. Maybe one significant event that happened in terms of addressing the small arms proliferation was the Niger Delta Amnesty Program, which to some extent, we don't have access to the numbers, but to some extent, a lot of these militant groups came and dropped down their arms exchange for training and education. You probably know this more than I do, that there are still millions of arms in the creeks still waiting. So let's not even talk about other parts of Nigeria where it is. It's a general problem that is putting West Africa at risk.
Yeah.
Putting political instability at the forefront right now for Nigeria. And we are almost breaking point because almost everybody can now access these arms.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it didn't also help geopolitically. The invasion of Libya in 2011 did not help matters at all. It created new small arms windows in the Sahel region. And we all know how interconnected Nigeria is with the Sahel region by virtue of our very open borders.
Exactly.
We actually have over 3,000 border posts, according to the Nigerian Immigration Service.
3,000?
Over 3,000 border posts. And most of these border posts are unmanned. So look at the access that a lot of these, that's why a lot of these herders can move from Mali and Niger to Chad and Cameroon and come into the country and go out anytime. You can come in, commit atrocities and leave. So as I said, it's a very complex, multi-faceted problem. And you're not going to solve the problem by just attending to one of the low-hanging fruit. It's a lot.
Wow.
We'll have to talk about border security. We'll have to talk about the non-kinetic efforts. We'll have to talk about amnesties. We still have to talk about amnesties now. That's a very veritable tool. It's unfortunate because that tool can also be used as an incentive for more violent outbursts. But when done very well, it can get a lot of these dangerous groups out of the way. Unfortunately, we don't have the political will to do very well.
Wow. Oh, Basil, it's interesting. It's very interesting.
Listen or watch more episodes of Think Big for Africa podcast with new guests every week. Subscribe to ensure that you are notified whenever new episodes are available.